Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is a jack-of-all-trades storyteller who I am eager to talk to today, Brandon Easton, who's known for, was it Watson and Holmes?
Yeah.
And you've got a new one?
There's a lot. Which one?
Shadow Law is the one I saw.
Yeah, Shadow Law came out in 2012. Watson and Holmes is something I did back in 2013. Then there was DeAndre the Giant biography called Closer to Heaven. The newest stuff would be Transformers Deviations from IDW Publishing. And then I just got hired to write some stuff for Marvel Comics summer event, Civil War II.
And you were also a staff writer for Agent Carter Season 2, which...
That is correct.
Which Jenny Koch, our resident, she's a sci-fi author herself. She adores Agent Carter, and she just wanted to pass on a big hug and a kiss to you.
Oh, tell her I said thank you. I readily accept hugs and kisses from Agent Carter fans. They're amazing fans. I mean, I just wish I had more information for them because we still don't know if we're getting a season 3. And with Haley Atwell already on a new show, I really don't know what to say next. So we'll see, I guess.
Well, there have been people who've worked multiple shows before. It's not easy, but it's possible. And given that Agent Carter is normally a mid-season run, I can see where it could be done.
It's possible, but we would need a whole lot of things to go in the right direction at one time. So I'm hoping, but to all the Agent Carter fans who may be listening, until ABC Studios and Marvel Entertainment or Marvel Television puts out an official press release, don't believe all the rumors you've heard online. Because somebody took it upon themselves and made up like a fake press release saying that ABC was bringing it back and it went viral. And it's absolutely not true. So, unfortunately, we still haven't had an official yes or no. So, we'll see what happens.
So, you are a writer.
Yes.
Who covers many, many different media.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have television, you have comics, you're also the writer and director of a documentary about the black writing experience in the 21st century.
Yeah.
How do you channel all of this and still manage to get enough sleep?
Well, that's a good one. This is how it works. The documentary, it's called Brave New Souls, Black Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of the 21st Century. That actually came out of incredible frustration because I would go back to around 2011 and 2012 where personally I felt there was this unrelenting upswell of anger and frustration from the African-American and whatever you want to call it, geek community about the lack of diversity within the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So they say. Whereas me personally, I not only knew a lot of black science fiction and fantasy writers with publishing deals at major publishers. We're not talking to them, and there's nothing against self-publishers or independent publishers, independent creators. But there were people who have deals at major publishing houses who, for whatever reason, just weren't getting any love from black creators, or anybody really. Like, there's been this massive cry for representation. And I kind of felt that, but these people are already out there doing this stuff. You're just not supporting their work. Mm-hmm. And some of it does, you know, in reality have to do with marketing and promotion because a lot of us, and I speak of African-American writers of science fiction and fantasy, a lot of us don't have a marketing budget. We can't afford publicists. So, you know, publishers in general don't do a great job of letting you know about their new material unless you do the research yourself, which a lot of people clearly aren't willing to do. So I felt that it would be a good idea to provide a window into some of the recent creators. Because everybody knows Sam Delaney. Everybody knows Octavia Butler. And then on a different level, people might know Stephen Barnes or Tanana Reeve Dhu or Nalo Hopkinson. But no one knew people like N.K. Jemisin, or Nnedi Okorafor, or Daniel Jose Older, or Jeffrey Thorne, or Kevin Grievous, or Hannibal Taboo, or Brandon Massey, or Lamar Giles. There's all these other names. I can keep going on and on. There's all these folks I know who are writers who have novels or work in comics or work in television or film who, for whatever reason, their names just keep falling under the radar. They keep being unknown. And I didn't understand how and why that was the case. So what I decided to do was take my meager resources at the time. And I was very lucky to be working with a company that was based in St. Louis, and they would fly me around to go to comic book conventions and science fiction conventions with them. So I was able to meet with people under any other circumstance I would not get a chance to meet. So I, being from the East Coast, I went back East and I would track down a couple of writers and creators. Then I went to the Midwest, to Chicago and St. Louis, and had conversations. And I met people here in the Los Angeles area where I live. So I was able to get a cross-section of recent African-American creators who normally wouldn't get any sunshine at all. And that's how I did that. And it took about a year to produce that. And unfortunately, I wasn't there for the editing of it, which made me very upset to see the final products. I had no control over how the person edited it. But it did end up on Amazon Instant, and it's streaming there currently. So I just wanted to, at the very least, provide a roadmap for those who didn't know about or don't know about certain new writers in the 21st century who haven't gotten the attention they deserve. Because it's not even just for Black readers. I mean, anyone can read their work. I mean, N.K. Jemisin and Nnedi Okorafor specifically have gotten a lot of praise and Hugo's and Nebula Award nominations and wins. And I just felt like, particularly those two, I'm like, why aren't more people talking about them? You know, why is it that there's this cognitive dissonance between the fan base and the creators who have all this beautiful material? So I just kind of wanted to eliminate that. I wanted to provide a map or even a red carpet so that folks could see what was out there. And that was why I did that one.
Now, the movie, the documentary first came out in 2014. Has anything changed in that year and a half, 2 years, that you would feel compelled to, say, make a part two for?
I would love to make a part two only so that I could be there for the editing process, because, to be quite frank, the guy who edited it did not do anything that I asked for. He left out some incredible conversations. I mean, for whatever made it in, there were conversations with those same people that were 10 times more hard-hitting, 10 times more, I think, cognizant, 10 times more valuable to aspiring creators. So if anything, I would like to do like a 2.0 version of it. And in the middle of that, maybe interview some more people. I mean, in the short term, I think a lot of those folks who were profiled did get some attention. Some of them have gotten work. I don't know if it's because of the documentary, but it definitely did help for their profiles to be raised considerably. Particularly doing with fans. It's not so much about production companies or studios or publishers as much as it is about the fan base. Because you can sign with the biggest production company or publisher in the world, and if people aren't buying your work, then it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You know. So I do think that, I do believe for a fact, and I've seen it, where some of these folks have gotten increased attention because of the documentary. I would definitely love to go back and re-edit it, completely re-edit it myself, or sit there with the whole editing process from beginning to end. And I would like to interview some more people who I think have come about in the last couple of years, people who I would have liked to have interviewed the first time around who didn't show up when I needed them or didn't believe I was serious. You know, there's a whole production thing where nobody takes you seriously until it's done.
Right, right.
You know, and that's kind of where I was. I had put out a call for interviews many times on between Facebook and Twitter and all these other places, and I had quite a few people respond, but then somehow they wanted me to magically teleport to wherever corner of the country they were in, and I was like, well, I can't do that, and I'm not going to, and this is where I'm going to be on these dates, and if you can make it, great. Otherwise, we have to wait till another time. And some people got really offended by it. There were people who were independent and self-publishers who got really offended by it, but I had a very specific reason for not including them. So I think that in the future, I might include more of the independent and self-publishing community, but I definitely wanted to get folks who already had standard deals in the mainstream so that I could show that there were people who somehow just weren't getting the attention they deserve. So yeah, I would definitely love to redo it and add some more names and faces to it.
Yeah, because it's, in my experience, it's the path of least resistance. People aren't going to go search out somebody new
Right.
unless enough people in their circle are talking about this. And they're like, well, wait, what am I missing out on? Who is this person? And
Yeah.
the big mainstream media companies are the ones who have the marketing budget and the distribution channels to get that media to where they expect to see it, either on the
Right.
shelves at Best Buy or Barnes and Noble or at Amazon. They want it to pop up in their Amazon recommended list, else they're not going to go searching for it because they don't know that person's name. So
Right.
the damned if you do and damned if you don't, right?
No, I mean you're absolutely correct about that, and that's where it began for me, where I wanted to try to find a way to get these names out there. I mean, it's a double-edged sword because on one hand, you see people who will obviously follow, the path of least resistance, and then I see people who scour the internet for everything except black authors. Like there's a whole population of people I know who spend countless hours researching the minutiae of all these story universes, but would never think to put in black science fiction writers in a Google search. So it's this weird thing where folks just aren't, it's like a short circuit somewhere where people just aren't thinking about how to get to the folks that they want. Because I'm not talking about the science fiction geek of any background who doesn't really care who writes it. I'm specifically targeting the folks who will complain, who will relentlessly complain until the cows come home about there not being black this and black that, or they will make unfair demands upon white writers to tell our stories. That doesn't make any sense to me. Like, as a man, I wouldn't expect, like, if a woman came to me, and I have many, friends, obviously I know women, and I try to write strong women characters who don't get raped on every other page and who have a sense of urgency that has nothing to do with men, But I'm not a woman. And no matter how much research and effort I put into it, there's things I'm not going to be able to get because I'm not a woman. And I accept that. And that's not an excuse not to write women. It's just a reality. And I don't expect to be as good as a woman writer writing women, no matter how good I am. You know what I mean? Like, I'll do the best I can, but there's things about being a woman that a guy knows nothing about, clearly. And I think that there are things of being an African American or a person of color that a white writer will not really, even if you're married to a person of color, even if your child is, biracial, whatever, is ethnically mixed, you're still not going to get certain aspects of reality that I'm going to experience as a, let's say, a black man, right? So I don't expect, and nor do I put an unfair weight or burden upon a white writer to tell my story. And I feel that, and this is coming from a writer's perspective especially, I feel that it's really unfair for a lot of the African American fan. It's not even, it's not everybody. There's a section of the black genre readership who just never happy with anything. And no matter who creates it, something's wrong with it. And they usually aim their animus toward white writers. But while they ignore black writers who are telling the stories that they want to be told by white writers, but black writers are already doing it. So I'm like, why are you complaining? Like, stop. If you took as much time of retweeting our work as much as you did tearing down someone else's, we would see a paradigm shift in the marketplace. But because they would rather bitch and complain about Tolkien or John Scalzi or someone else. I mean, it's always somebody they target and be like, "Oh, well, why aren't they telling our stories?" Because they don't have to. That's not their job. They can tell whatever story they, if they don't want to put any black people or women or Latinos or whatever, if they don't want to put anybody else in their story, so what? We can write our own stuff. We have written our own stuff. We have, like, volumes of stuff that people aren't buying, filled with black characters doing amazing stuff, or people of color, or transgendered, or gay or lesbian. You know, it's already out there. Just start buying it.
And I'm sitting here, I'm laughing because I'm thinking, I thought that level of nitpicky, mindless nitpickiness was reserved for like Batman, Spider-Man, no, Superman.
No. I think there's something to all of us, particularly us who are fans of science fiction, of the genres in general, you know, sci-fi, fantasy, what horror. We are all damaged because we love this stuff. And I don't mean it in a negative way. I mean it that like we are on some level dented so that we love this stuff so much and we want to get into that world and we take it very seriously. I mean, there are people who get mad. There are people who just get mad at Tolkien's language, his elf language. There are people who write in that language and there's like a war between two different camps of people who interpret his elvish differently. You know, I've seen this online and I was like, what? I didn't even know this existed.
No, it's funny to me because me and a couple of friends of mine in high school, we wrote notes back and forth to each other in Elvish because our teachers couldn't read them.
Exactly. There you go. That's awesome. And that's what I'm talking about. That, yeah, that nitpickiness is in novels, it's in comics, it's in TV. But there's a very specific fandom of, and it's because like there's a huge African-American, and I'm being very specific here, there's a huge African-American genre fan base. They're at every convention you ever go to. Mm-hmm. They're all over the world, you know, not just African, but black African diaspora fans, right? Then within that community, there's this very small nitpicky group who just want to attack non-black creators about not creating black material. And that doesn't make any sense to me. And that's who I made that documentary for specifically. That's the first audience that I would love to just like strap them down like in Clockwork Orange and pry their eyes open and make them watch it and say, okay, now you can stop complaining because here are the people who are doing what you're asking for. If you would just stop complaining about everything else and buy, or just, you don't even have to buy it, just retweet it. You know, just let people know we exist, then all the complaining will go away. But some people just have to complain. So, you know, they don't want a solution.
You know, I honestly would love to ask the question of them, what is wrong with this? Because this book right here, or this comic right here, or this TV show right here is exactly right. What you're asking for.
Right.
What's wrong with it that it doesn't meet your standards?
What? Okay. All right. Well, wow. I actually do. I have two answers for that because I got the answers from these people because I've gotten into Twitter wars and I just stopped talking to them because this is one person who is so incredibly unreasonable that, well, actually, there's two in particular, but this one is exceptionally ridiculous because she wraps herself in sociological truth while being remarkably ignorant of how the industry actually works. Those people are dangerous.
Pure academic is what you're saying.
Yeah, they're academics. But the thing is, some academics are reasonable because they operate from logic. But when you have an academic who's emotionally bent and cannot accept logic, then they use their formidable powers of academic recall to attack under this guise of a social responsibility. And that's where it becomes dangerous. And there's a lot of folks out there like that. And they refuse to get off their high horse. But anyway, the answer I got, the first one is that, well, no, Alex, one is the answer, one is the explanation. So I'll give you the explanation first.
Okay.
Some people, and this is true of a lot of folks, but within the African-American community, some of us, and this is where it gets deep, we exist in a realm of self-hate. So we tend to think like, oh, we don't hate our own selves. We don't hate our skin color. We don't hate how we view the world. But some of us do carry around a lot of self-hate because being black in a Western world is tough sometimes because we constantly get bombarded with negativity and about ourselves. And a lot of it's untrue, but we believe it because it's repeated so much. So what winds up happening is that we carry this inferiority inside of us without realizing it. So sometimes people will look at a book cover or a comic book or a film and see black faces and automatically assume it's going to be sucky, or it's going to be a piece of crap or ghetto. Without actually reading it, without actually giving it a chance, folks will look at it and be like, well, nope, there's a black person on it. It must be a thug book or a ghetto novel. Even if it has spaceships on it or dragons, people will still look at it and be like, oh, nope, I'm not going to give it a chance. So they'll look at a book that's written by, let's say, R.A. Salvatore or Brandon Sanderson or George R.R. Martin and be like, wow, this stuff is awesome, because they don't realize that they've made a Eurocentric decision in their own brain and heart. They don't even realize they're doing it because it's ingrained. So they'll look at these, you know, the Dragonlance novels or Game of Thrones or the all that stuff, you know, and they'll be like, oh, well, you know, this is really cool. But why aren't there any black people in it? Because in order for it to be justified, a white person has to create it. That's the only way it works. That's what's going on a very, at least this is my sociological examination and conclusion, that I feel that the self-hate that does exist within us manifests in our purchasing decisions. So we'll look at something, let's say, by Nnedi Okorafor or N.K. Jemisin or Lamar Giles or Brandon Massey, or these are some of the newer people, or Jeff Thorne or whoever, and we'll be like, oh, well, you know, it's a black person on it, and we'll add our own biases to it without realizing that that book is not even close to being that. So we don't pick it up. But then we'll pick up the Dragonlances or the War of Kings by Brandon Sanderson or all these other books, all these other major series, Wheel of Time, and we'll be like, oh, wow, this is so, because this is the mainstream legitimizes it. It has to be legitimate, and therefore it's an example of what fantasy or science fiction should be. So then the next logical thing is, oh, so why aren't we included? Not realizing that some of these books suck. Some of these books are written from an extremely ignorant and Eurocentric perspective. Some of these books are very misogynistic and just in general not pleasant reads. But we assume because it's white that it's right. It's the mainstream. It's the correct version. So we expect people in that community to tell our stories. So I think first the explanation is a lot of it comes from self-hate and we don't even realize it. That's the first half. The answer I got from these complainers is that we shouldn't let folks off the hook who aren't practicing the correct politics of representation, which again I personally feel is unfair, because I don't think any writer should be beholden to anybody else's whims, because if you're a writer, you tell the story you goddamn want to tell. You know, and I personally, I don't like rape in stories. I don't like blacks or any, because a lot of fantasy orcs are really black people. So they don't really call them blacks. But, you know, you look at what the society and how they describe them, it's basically black, the other. So, you know, I don't like representations of African or dark people to be savage or noble savage or rapists or murderers or, you know, people who pillage and destroy everything. But that's not my story. I won't write that story. I just need people to buy what I write, you know, or just read what I write. You can go check it out from a library, for God's sake. So that's how I look at that, why we have a black or a segment of the black genre community who just can't accept what we do. Because in their own mind, we're still invisible to them, because we're invisible because of their biases that they don't even realize they're carrying.
And part of what your answer was, or your explanation hit me as being, why should we as black writers, as, you know, multi-ethnic writers, why should the burden be on us to tell stories only of sociological import? Why can't we just tell a goddamn story?
And I agree with that. No, and you know, and again, I agree with that. I mean, if you look at N.K. Jemisin's 100,000 Kingdoms, you know, series, you know, it's not about race. I mean, she brings up issues, but these are issues that would be inherent to a fantasy world that has multicultural people, you know, because you're going to have the haves and have nots in any society, period.
Right.
And that's a story. And you don't have to do stratification based on skin color. But in Game of Thrones, there's stratification based on class. You know, the stratification is based on what country you come from. So that those are very real things that are in big stories. So, yeah, and I agree. I don't think a quote-unquote black writer has to tell a quote unquote black story, whatever that could be. But I do think that the issues that we face can be transposed in, let's like in Star Trek, for example, the issues that we face in society can be transposed to a science fiction context and be very, very well received and well documented. You know, I mean, Star Trek is the Cold War in space, basically, at certain points, particularly with the Klingons. And you didn't have to be obvious about it, but it was clearly there. You know what I mean? And you could tell a great story. Like, for example, there's a brother, Lamar Giles, or Giles. He wrote a book called Fake ID. And it's like a hacker kind of story, right? But race is in it, but that's not the story. You know, because the main character is African-American. And the 21st century, you're going to be dealing with some stuff. But that's not the core of the story. It's not Malcolm X. It's just a story about, it's like a young adult novel about a computer hacker who gets in over his head. And in the young adult world, you don't really get a lot of black male main characters at all. You know?
That's true, yeah.
I mean, period. It's always some pretty people who, you know, are teenagers who end up in circumstances ripped off of the Battle Royale movie that, you know, came out many years ago in Japan. So, which got transposed into Hunger Games, Maze Runner, and Divergent. It's the same story, basically.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, but my point is that, you know, it's just nice to have black people sometimes, you know. So it doesn't have to be a race thing. But, you know, when you have this incredible exclusion on a massive level, but then there are people remedying, whatever that is. They are solving their issue, they're solving the problem by creating their works. It's just nice to have those people get recognized just for not only being good authors, but for telling a story that has people that look like me. You know, I'm like, hey, sometimes I like to see myself in a book and not have everybody described like Jon Snow, which is like the majority of the men in most genre novels. You know, it's like, come on. You know, there are some brothers out there somewhere in the universe.
Yeah, and we have so many stories to tell. I mean, right now, look at the prevalence of haunted house stories and zombie stories. I mean, zombies, the mass turning into either brain dead or viral infected hordes that just destroy everything. That has become so prevalent a theme in stories, I'm going to say the past 6 to 7 years. I'm like, there's something bubbling under the surface that people really want to get out of their system, and they're channeling it through zombies.
Yeah.
And in the face of trying to survive such insurmountable odds, let me tell you, color don't matter.
Right. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. You're right. I mean, the zombie thing is a post-millennial kind of fear of loss of individuality, because we've lost privacy tremendously after September 11th. So it's like you're seeing this fear of loss of individuality, and zombies represent a mindless horde, which a lot of us are becoming because of social media, which is actually technically anti-social media because people don't actually congregate. So, you know, you see this weird shift in thinking where you have a huge population of people who are afraid that they're going to lose everything because no one's really connecting on the way we used to connect, which is a legitimate fear, because I fear that.
A virtual horde.
Which is what we've become.
Yeah.
I mean, you have, and the thing is, the virtual world tends to exacerbate the worst elements of humanity, which is basically zombiedom. You know, you have people mindlessly attacking everybody for whatever reason, instead of thinking carefully and logically about how to approach a situation, whether it's Gamergate or the sad puppies thing or anything at all. I mean, any little thing, people just look for a reason to start fighting and, you know, clawing at each other. And it's gotten ridiculous. You know, people say things about you they wouldn't say to your face, but they'll definitely say it online, you know. And it's just like a whole different way of thinking about the world. So, yeah, the zombies are a good reflection, our visual metaphor for that fear, which is crazy.
Yeah, it's like people believe that the internet is anonymous enough that they are allowed to attack anybody without recourse or thought to consequence. But yet some people have actually said stuff on Facebook that got them fired from their jobs. So there's a disconnect there. It's like, when did because I see people complaining about, well, that's too PC and PC is destroying everything.
Right. Like,
there's a difference between PC and just being generally compassionate and polite to your fellow human being, no matter what their background.
Right.
I mean, what? How did those two things get conflated? I don't get it.
I remember. I remember the moment it did. It was 1994 during the midterm elections, when Bill Clinton was president. I remember this happened, and when the Republicans got into office in 1994, a huge part of their platform was that you couldn't say what you felt anymore, that political correctness was destroying America, blah, 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 blah. And they got elected on that. And we're still seeing the remnants of that right now in our society, unfortunately, in the Donald Trump campaign. However, the anti-PC movement definitely gained steam in 1994. And I remember when it happened. And I thought to myself, okay, now people are going to hide behind, they're going to use freedom of speech to hide their bigotry and their biases. You behind that. You know, they want to use that as a shield. And our First Amendment does protect, unfortunately, hate speech to a point. However, you have a lot going on there. You have a educational system that is, and I'm a former public school teacher. I taught for 6 years in New York. Trust me when I say.
New York, wow.
New York isn't, compared to some school systems, New York is not bad at all. Trust me.
No, that's a high bar to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So trust me when I say our educational system is putting people who do not understand the phrase critical thinking at all, and you have people who are overrun with ignorance, with lack of life experience. I mean, I saw something the other day, well, actually years ago, that blew my mind, that most people in our society are born, grow up, work, and die within 20 square miles of where, you know, where they were born at. They never leave. And when you have a whole population of people who just stay in their town or stay in their neighborhood, who watch the news, and, you know, corporate media sucks, you know, they don't have experience of their own, so they vicariously live through stronger personalities, which are usually lunatics, you know? So you have a population of people who think that being able to express bigotry is the same as free speech, which in a sense it is. But they don't know the difference between having – first of all, a lot of folks don't know how to do self-examination at all. It took me until I was 20 years old. And that was only because I was far away from home and in a college I didn't want to be at, that I was forced to evaluate my own way of thinking about the world. And that included my own issues of race, my own issues of sexism, being a man, my own issues of homophobia that I didn't even think I had. But I went through a process of self-evaluation where I challenged myself on my own issues. I'd say maybe, 2% of the world does that? You know, I mean, and I'm not saying I'm better. I was just forced to do it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that I did it, you know, on my own recognizance. No, I was forced to challenge the way I thought about the world. The average person doesn't do that. So you've got people who have access to the internet who thinks that their way of viewing the world is the absolute. And anything outside of their very narrow bubble is deeply problematic. And that's why you get arguments about PC and social justice and blah, blah, blah. And I should be able to say what I want and yam, yam, yam. And, you know, and it just goes on and on to this nebula of nonsense. That's what it is.
And that's funny because my viewpoint is kind of the same. I had a very, very diverse upbringing, very, very, I traveled a lot. I saw a lot of stuff. And the changes in the economic status of so many people the past, I'm going to say 20 years, people don't travel. People don't leave home. People, more and more people can't afford to go to college.
Right.
To be exposed to that diversity that's out in the world because it, you know, your next best thing, you know, go to a school that has 40,000, 50,000, 100,000 people, you're going to get a wide slice of life selection from the people you're going to start interacting with. And we're just becoming more and more and more. We're reverting back to tribes, basically.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. You're absolutely correct.
And what is it? Robert E. Howard, bless his heart, he had a saying that's it's actually on the bag that I got from one of the World Fantasy conventions I went to, World Fantasy award ceremonies I went to. The bag, it said, the natural human state is barbarism. Civilization is a whim, and we all eventually revert back to barbaric tribes, basically. And unfortunately, the hate, the anger, the economic disenfranchisement of so many people, not just, we're talking by class, by economic status, we're reverting back to tribes. And I think that is what's spawning a lot of people to tell stories, because they have no other way to get this out of their system.
Wow. Yeah. And wow. Okay. That just hit me hard. I'm like, good God, that makes a lot of sense. And that's logic. And that's what I'm getting at. Like, people don't think anymore. Conversations like this need to be had on a macro level. And when you've got Fox News and other claptrap out there just giving you like less than 0.5% of what's actually happening, people make decisions and build their lives around that. So
I gave up on network news 15 years ago. I gave up on, newspapers stopped being relevant. I lived in New Jersey for 10 years. Thank God I escaped.
Mm-hmm. That's funny.
I felt like I was dying. In New Jersey, it felt like my soul was being sucked dry. And then I realized, unless you're born in New Jersey, you don't have the proper antibodies to survive there. And unless you get out, you will blow your brains out. So I managed to escape a little bit. But it's just everybody wants to report the most negative thing possible. Mm. And that reinforces the despair, the hatred, the anger. And trust me, I have my own share of anger issues. And I don't always want to see that in my news. I don't want to see that all the time in my entertainment. I love grim and gritty entertainment. I thought the new Battlestar Galactica was one of the best stories I had ever experienced. And this is coming from someone who was a diehard fan of the original. I was a teenager when the original Battlestar Galactica came out. In fact, the way everything worked in what I was allowed to see and not allowed to see, I saw Battlestar Galactica before I saw the first Star Wars.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That wow. It's really weird, because Star Wars came out May 77. And it was playing in first run theaters for a year and a half. Do you remember that?
No, yeah. I don't. Wow.
I remember ads in the Washington Post movie section that said 105th week, know, stuff like that. And, 85th week, I think, is when I finally saw it. But I had seen it. It was after Battlestar Galactica, the 3-hour premiere on TV, which was September 78.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I actually saw Star Wars in the theater after I had seen
That's awesome.
Battlestar Galactica. And that was, my sci-fi geekdom actually started earlier than that, because I think it was 5 years before. Was it five? Yeah, 5 years before Galactica aired on TV, the first comic book I bought was an issue of Black Panther.
Hmm.
And something about the artwork of that cover, just, it's burned into my mind. It's Black Panther standing on a tree branch fighting, hand to hand with another guy who's dressed in a regular leopard suit. And then on the ground is a real Black Panther and a real leopard squaring off in a fight.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And I just saw that, and I had to have it. And my mom just finally just bought me the comic, 25 cents of it.
That's awesome.
And said, here, just go sit in the corner and read till I'm done shopping.
Awesome.
And I didn't know back then that comic books kept coming out every month. Otherwise, I wouldn't have kept reading.
Yes.
But,
for a very long time.
Yeah. I didn't know these things at 8 years old. I just thought, I'm like, hey, this is a cool cover. Let me see this. My introduction to science fiction and to, I'm going to say, the war between the classes, the war between the haves and the have-nots, the war between whoever, that has been a very, very big part of the kind of stories I read, because I like reading the struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, going back to what you were saying earlier, the fact that some people complain when the struggle isn't, you know, socially responsible or socially impactful makes no sense to me. It just has to be a good story. I mean, you can't have a class war or an economic war or an interstellar war just to have a war. There has to be a reason for
exactly
for the fighting, and those characters have to have reasons for fighting on either side. I don't know, just what am I trying to say here? The overcoming the struggle, overcoming your self-limitations while you're trying to overcome other battles, other obstacles. Those are stories I think people need, and right, focusing on the negativity ain't going to get us there.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, I agree.
All right. Enough with the deep stuff.
Yes.
Let's talk about Transformers. Is there any new Transformers stuff coming along that you can talk about?
Well, not stuff that I'm working on, unfortunately. There is some stuff that let me back up a bit. You know, for those who don't know, the Transformers comics are still being published by IDW Publishing, and they're doing a fantastic job, actually. There was, the book I wrote was called Transformers Deviations, which is an alternate universe peek at what if Optimus Prime survived the events of Transformers the movie in 1986. And those, you know, Transformers fans will remember that Optimus died in his battle with Megatron. And as a result, the entire Transformers universe changed forever. So I got a chance to write that, which was, being able to rewrite the 1986 Transformers movie was one of the greatest jobs of my life. I'm like still shocked over it. But IDW has a big Hasbro world in general. They have G.I. Joe. They've got, I think, Jem is a Jem comic book.
Yeah.
And I think some other stuff is coming.
I said, don't get me started on that Jem movie.
Yeah, right. Oh, no, I'm not going to talk about it. I didn't even see it. I mean, that's one of those things where it was so obviously egregious that wasn't going to work.
It's like, but, how do you call that Jem? Whoever wrote that never watched the animation. And that animation is beloved by women, girls of all colors.
And guys, trust me. I love that show, by the way.
Anyway.
So I know that right now there was a big storyline. There is a big storyline going on in the Transformers comic books from IDW that started with issue 50 of both of their titles. I would suggest Transformers fans, if any are listening, please read those books, because there's a lot of really cool stuff coming up in the next year. I'm not working on them, but I was privy to hearing some of the ideas, and they're really amazing. I can't talk about it, but really cool. So, Transformers stuff is still going along. It's still kind of a close to what we remember. It's not exactly – it's nothing like the Michael Bay movies, thank God. So it's very much set in a Transformers world that you'll recognize. So nothing looks like trash cans. So that's that. So that's as far as Transformers goes that I can talk about.
So what else can you talk about today? What are you currently working on that we can look forward to seeing?
Let's see. The reality is that I am in the middle of staffing season for TV writers, which is that period of time in April and May when TV writers trying to figure out if their show is coming back or if it's time to look for a new gig, which I am clearly looking for a new gig. So I've met on a lot of shows, and that's been going very well. I don't really have anything to report yet,
But there's definitely some good stuff coming up, and I cannot wait to make an announcement once I'm sure that I can make an announcement. So unfortunately, again, I can't say too much, but there is some really cool stuff coming up. Now, I can talk about the Marvel Comics stuff that I'm working on, which is the Night Thrasher short story in the upcoming Civil War II summer event series from Marvel Comics. And that's really cool. And I can talk about that. So if you had any questions about that one, I'd be happy to.
He said, this is new, so go right ahead.
Well, okay. Civil War II is an upcoming Marvel Comics big summer crossover event, which is going to affect the entire Marvel Comics universe. The basic concept, without ruining anything, is that Captain Marvel, who is Carol Danvers, and Tony Stark, Iron Man, are going to have a major disagreement about how they should go about protecting the Earth. And a lot of it has to do with issues raised in the film Minority Report, whether or not if you had a way of preventing a tragedy or a crime before it happened, would you, you know, in a preventative sense, go and arrest someone or go and knock out someone who was going to commit an atrocity? And the argument goes, well, predestination is generally problematic because when you do something, you change the future. So the argument is whether or not you should act on a premonition, or should you wait to at least get close to that event before you do it, because it might not even happen at all.
And or you might change how it happens by taking action too soon, or you taking create, the wrong action, right?
Like in Minority Report, you create the problem. So that is the thematic and story core of Civil War II. It's whether or not you should change the future or protect it. And the story I'm writing is about a character named Night Thrasher, who used to be the leader of the New Warriors, the Marvel Comics teen super team. He was resurrected last year, and as comic book heroes are. And within the anthology I'm writing, the general idea is that he is trying to figure out which side he's going to join, whether or not he believes in joining the Tony Stark side or the Captain Marvel side. And in my piece, there's a little bit of a quandary about how you look at the future. Do dominoes fall as they're supposed to, or do dominoes fall because we create an attractive pattern for ourselves? And that's kind of how I look at the change versus protect the future idea.
Now, is your short an entire comic, or is it like a one shot, or?
No, it's a 10-page story within a larger anthology that may or may not lead to a much bigger story. And that's all I can say about that.
Okay.
It's a setup. I'll leave it at that. When people read it, they'll be like, oh, I see what he's talking about. So, yeah.
So are you looking forward to, well, since it's called Civil War II, I have to imagine that somehow its roots are in the new Captain America Civil War movie.
No, it has nothing to do with that.
Oh, really?
No, Civil War I happened back in the early 2000s, right. And it was Captain America versus Tony Stark. And it was all about the Superhero Registration Act,
right?
Whether or not heroes should have to be beholden to the U.S. government and register like you go to a DMV, but with their superpowers, or should you not have to be under control of a government? So Captain America was like, no. And Tony was like, yes, and that started the whole big thing. It turned out the whole thing was secretly manipulated by a bad guy to begin with, which makes sense. But this one is, fortuitously, it's coming out right after the Civil War movie, but it actually has no ties whatsoever to the Civil War film. It was smart to schedule this storyline for this time, but it is not connected to the movie at all.
Oh. So why call? I hate it when they Civil War II. It's a misleading title.
Well, if you read the original Civil War, then you know it's a sequel to that. But since a lot of people didn't, they're going to, in their mind, connect it to the movie, and it may lead to some sales.
Yeah. Well, for your sake, I hope it does.
Yeah. I mean, I know what's coming. It's really awesome.
Okay. That said, are you looking forward to the movie?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is how I look at it, right? I've not reached a level of cynicism or jadedness where I'm going to look at a superhero movie and be nitpicky about it. I grew up, and I was born in 74. I grew up during the 80s, really grew up. Mm-hmm. And I remember what superhero films, when we got them, looked like.
Oh, dear goodness.
I remember how few we got. And then I remember something that this generation absolutely has no idea about. And I'll explain it. And this is a core of my being as a fan. I was a big fan of Starlog magazine.
Oh, yeah.
I loved Starlog. And I remember how what we would call forum wars or geek wars were waged within the pages, the letters pages of Starlog, as well as Fangoria and other genre magazines at the time. I remember one aspect of fandom that these kids, quite, I hate to even talk like this, but these kids nowadays know nothing about. And that quality of fandom is gratitude. When I was coming up, most of the superhero films, with the exception of scant few, were absolutely horrible. And the one thing that fandom did was look for the good in it. We would write letters, and there would be whole articles in Fangoria, and well, particularly Starlog, about why, yeah, this might have sucked, but this is what was cool about it. Now, no matter how cool it is, people are looking for reasons why it's not. And I'm like, what the hell are people like? It's like, guys, we're in a literal golden age of superhero media.
Yes.
There are more. I mean, I think people are spoiled because it's like, if you don't get what you want on a movie, you could turn on a CW or CBS or Fox or whatever, and or ABC, and you could get what you want in every aspect of super. You even have different superhero movie companies. I mean, comic book companies with different properties on, you know, in different places. So if you're a DC fan, there's plenty for you to watch. If you're a Marvel fan, if you enjoy animation too, there's plenty for you to watch.
Yep.
So for me, I look forward to almost every superhero movie from every company featuring every character. I do not get angry. I do not create wars. I do not get like nitpicky. I'm like, okay, if it wasn't great, so what? There's going to be another one in a month. I'll move on. I don't take it personally and plant my Marvel flag or Star Wars flag or Star Trek flag. Look, I like Star Trek and Star Wars. I don't understand why there has to be this, like, this combative community thing, this like diametrical opposition. Like, what is it with that? Like, it doesn't make any sense. So, yes, I am very much looking forward to Civil War. I'm looking forward to Suicide Squad. I'm looking forward to Doctor Strange. I'm looking forward to all of it. I'm looking forward to all of it. If it sucks, guess what? I move on. I don't make a big, I mean, there are people still bitching and complaining about Batman versus Superman, which I personally didn't think was that bad, but people are like waging, you know, like they're acting like someone raped their mom. Yeah. I'm like, dude, like, calm down. It's a movie, you know? Just move on. There's other movies. There's millions of them. Like, I just don't get it. Like, I don't know. I mean,
You're messing with the hero worship. And yeah. this confuses and makes them sad, and they don't want to be sad, so they lash out.
But my thing is I get the hero worship part, but I also, as a educated consumer, realize that bitching and complaining about it is not going to change anything.
Yeah.
Superman versus Batman is still on track to make $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what it'd be.
Which pretty much ensures that the Justice League movies will get made, which I'm looking forward to.
Those movies were going to get made no matter how Batman versus Superman did. See, this is the thing that a lot of, and I hate to say it like this, but I'm going to speak from someone who works in the industry. This is what a lot of folks don't understand. And I said this on panels, and people look at me like they want to slit my throat. But what a lot of fans think, what a lot of fans bitch and complain about, guess what? Nobody cares.
True.
I'm going to say this again. Nobody cares what you think. And I say that because there's a multi-billion, even trillion-dollar industry that will churn out product irregardless of what you think. The comic book fan base as a physical number is not large enough to affect change in movie-going habits. Because if every comic book fan in the nation did not go see Batman versus Superman, it's still going to make $1 billion. Because the physical number of fans that bitch and complain is not equal to the fan who does not give a crap about all this stuff. They just want to be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a lot of these fans don't get. I learned my lesson the hard way And I'll tell you how I had this great awakening or epiphany. It's the Transformers series. Now, a lot of people don't, I mean, people who know me know this, but I'm a big Transformers fan. I've been a Transformers fan since the first day I saw the cartoon in 1984. I've been a fan consistently straight through since then. I used to bitch and complain throughout the 90s about this and that. Then when the Michael Bay movies, I would complain. And then I realized one day with the second really horrible, one of the worst films ever made, I think, is the second Transformers movie, period. So yeah. I realized then that no matter how much I complained and yelled and shook my fist at the sky, Michael Bay is still going to make $100 million off that movie. All the actors are going to make a big chunk of money. All the producers and screenwriters, all these people are going to make their points on the film. Therefore, nothing I say made any difference in the film. It doesn't make a difference. They don't care what I think. They don't care. So rather than yell and scream about it, I just stopped talking about it. And this is something I've learned from working in the industry. And I want to share this with everybody. And I hope you folks listening really take this to heart. Every time you mention you hate something and you call it by name, you're creating a social media imprint for that product because it's a product.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say, I hate Batman versus Superman, the fact that you said Batman versus Superman is registered as a social media imprint, which leads to eventually leads to advertising and marketing revenue for the film. So the very thing you hate, you're helping get free advertising.
Yeah, what's the old adage? There's no such thing as bad publicity.
I'm going to tell you, in the 21st century, particularly with social media and revenue streaming and all this stuff, how money is made through social media imprint, all the people whining and complaining about Batman versus Superman are doing nothing but increasing its profile online. And that's something I wish people would get. So if you don't like something, don't talk about it. You know, I don't like Rihanna, the singer, right? By mentioning her now, I'm helping her, but I'm going to give an example. Nowhere in my social media do I mention Rihanna because I don't like her. So I don't like what she creates. I don't like the images she puts out. I don't like the messages she puts out. So there, or Lil Wayne, for example, the rapper. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I don't mention them in my Facebook page or my Twitter feed or my Instagram because I don't want them getting any attention because of what I'm saying. So by ignoring it, you're taking away from them getting attention. So in the future, if you don't like something, just ignore it. Trust me, that works more. Boycotting something actually works. And a social media boycott also works. So I feel that fans need to understand that if you want to really hurt something, don't spend your money on it and then stop talking about it. That's how you hurt it.
So it's the reverse psychology of talk to the hand.
Right, because think about this, right? I always talk about bullies and mean girls in school, right?
Mm-hmm.
The only reason bullies and mean girls in school got any kind of power is because people paid attention to them. If you don't pay attention to the bully and mean girl, they lose all their power. That's where they derive their power from, attention. That's how it works. Attention is power. Attention equals economics. And if you ignore something completely, like if you like dating someone, you don't want to, you ignore them, right? You just cut them off. That, like, how do you take away power from a bad relationship? You ignore the person. That drives them crazy, but it gives you power because you're not giving them what they need, which is the attention to bring it really down to earth. So the same thing works with products. If you don't like something, don't talk about it. Don't spend your money on it. Don't mention Warner Brothers or DC Comics or Marvel or Hasbro, whoever it is. If you don't talk about them or Del Rey or Ballantine or Random House, if you don't talk about their product, they lose power. That's how it works.
Yep. I totally agree because, like I said, my big thing is comedies. Romantic comedies or just comedies in general, slapstick comedies. I don't like comedies. I could probably name 3 to 5 comedic films.
Right.
And I'd actually have to be hard pressed to sit and name them right now. But what passes for comedy these days just makes me nauseous. And mm-hmm. I don't talk about them. Like, yeah, that's your type of movie. Go for it. It's all you. You can go. Not me. And just ignoring something, Even when something happens that I don't like or I'm not sure about, I try to find the positive in it.
Right, right.
For instance, with Doctor Strange, the Doctor Strange movie, I love Benedict Cumberbatch. Mm-hmm. But when it was announced that he was going to be Doctor Strange, my reaction was, I'm glad this movie's being made. I love Benedict Cumberbatch. I'm not sure he's 100% right for the role because mm-hmm. the Doctor Strange that I grew up with was a little older. Mm-hmm. And I tried to do a little analysis of that. And I said, I'm going to reserve judgment and wait to see the movie. Because A, Doctor Strange is one of my boys, and Cumberbatch is an awesome, just amazing actor.
Right.
But I had my reservations of him being cast. So I see the positive. The movie's getting made. They needed somebody of, I'm going to say, recognition, name recognition to play the role, to bring people to the character who most mainstream America outside of Marvel, diehard Marvel fans have no idea who Doctor Strange is.
Right, exactly.
So yeah. bringing his name in to get that recognition cachet, I understand that. But as a old school Marvel girl who Doctor Strange is one of her favorites, I have to go, I'm not sure about this, but I'm going to go see it anyway. So I understand how fans just start complaining about stuff. But yeah, I like what you're saying about look for the good. What about, because you went and saw it. You went and saw right. it twice, even though you hated it.
Right.
There must have been something good in there that you liked. What was it?
Well, the thing is, you know, and you raise a great point. I mean, I can't control if people complain. I can't control if people get upset. I mean, mm-hmm. people are going to. I mean, people don't listen to me, clearly. I just feel that there's so much energy wasted because I go back to this. Whenever there's something I don't like, and instead of like wishing it would, you know, conform to the things that I want, I just go find something that is already like it. I'm a writer, so I create stuff myself. But if I wasn't a writer and when I wasn't writing as much and I didn't like something, I would just go find something new or different. I'm a big space opera fan, and there's a trillion space opera novels out there. You know, Tor probably produces most of them, you know. but, you know, there's also a trillion military space adventure. And I'm not always the biggest fan of military space, but I'm also not the biggest fan of hard sci-fi where I got to read 17 physics formulas to understand what's going on. You know, so I kind of like the big, sprawling, swashbuckling space epics, you know. And there's not a lot of really good ones. So you have to, you know, wade through it, spend some money. And then I found an author I like, a guy named Alan Steele. And I read all of his books until I stopped liking them. And I was like, okay, he's gone into a place I don't like. So instead of getting mad about it, I just find somebody new. Because we have options. If it's one thing in the 21st century we have, more than anything else in the first world, is entertainment options.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't like something, there are, 400 scripted TV shows right now. 400. If you don't like one show, I guarantee there's going to be another show out there that you'll probably like if you give it a chance. But that means giving it a chance.
Yep.
And that means letting go of all the whining and complaining. And that's where I get on. That's why I don't understand is why folks just want to keep on whining and complaining. It's like shouting into a black hole, which is physically impossible. But sound, you know, if you could shout into a black hole, it wouldn't make a difference. You know, I mean, that's what people are doing. You know, you can't, like, you're shouting into this abyss of nothingness. No one's listening. You're arguing with people. Like, I see it online every day. I spend a lot of time online for business reasons. And I'm just like, folks, what don't you get? Like, no one cares. Like, the people who would actually consider what you're saying will never listen to you because you're not on their level. Like, you need to be in a studio at a certain level as a producer or a writer or someone with money that provides the money, because that's another factor. If you're like an investor, they really listen to you. But but if you're not in that circle, all the complaining you're doing is basically going into nothingness. You know, and I wish more folks would get that, because if you keep spending your money on it, guess what? They're going to keep making it.
you know. And if you keep, if, you know, and if you don't like an author and you don't want to spend your money, go to a library. I mean, folks, you can go to libraries, you know, and you can look at the book, the first chapter, and if you don't like it, don't get the book.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I just look at things very simply and pragmatically because I don't like spending money on things that I don't like. So I try to spend money on things that I do like, you know, or support. It's very simple to me.
All right. Let's wrap this up with one last entertainment-related question.
Sure.
What TV shows have you excited and thrilled this year? That, wow. That personally, that you don't want to miss, that you can't miss, that you have fallen in love with?
Brand new or returning?
Either.
Well, I'm a big fan of like the, what I call the Berlantiverse. So that's like Arrow, Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, Supergirl. I also enjoy Blindspot. I love How to Get Away with Murder. I really enjoy 11/22/63 on Hulu. Mm-hmm. I really like Man in a High Castle, which I actually adapted into a screenplay many years ago. Very few people know about it. And it didn't go anywhere, but I actually did adapt that one time.
As a longtime Philip K. Dick fan, I love you.
God bless you. Thank you very much. It was a graduate school project that we tried to turn into a legitimate thing, but it didn't happen. But I really enjoyed adapting that book. I am a big comedy fan, but I tend to like darker, irreverent stuff. I'm not a fan of safe family comedies. Like I like stuff like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Broad City. Really disgusting, wacky, ridiculous black, quote unquote black, not race, but black humor. I like dark, wacky stuff. You know, it has to be wacky. I'm trying to think, what else do I enjoy? Like, there's so much stuff on my DVR that, on my queue, I should say, that is so backed up that I'm trying to catch up on. But I like a lot of different stuff. It's not just genre. I like a good crime story. I like really good, I like political stuff. I really enjoyed 24 a lot when it was new. I liked the X-Files. I mean, even though the X-Files reboot was flawed, it was very nice to see those people again. I was very happy with that, actually. Because sometimes you just want to go home again. And not home like X-Files home, but which, you know, some people may know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
but,
just revisit that world because you had so much fun in it the last
time. Yeah. So, I mean, I really enjoyed just seeing Mulder and Scully again and seeing the wackiness between them and just the wacky world of Darren Morgan and Chris Carter and the rest of that gang. It was just a lot of fun, you know, and I really miss that kind of fun on television. You know, I feel that, you know, the reason why Deadpool resonated so much was because it was just fun. And I think, you know, like, I think the, like, the, well, Flash and Legends of Tomorrow are a lot of fun. Supergirl is not afraid to be cheesy at all. And that's what makes it fun. And I like stuff like that. I mean, I tried to watch Gotham, but that's not Batman to me. Like, it feels like, okay, when that kid grows up, that means Batman is going to be beating up on middle-aged psychopaths. That doesn't make sense, but okay. So I tried to watch Gotham, but it didn't work. Oh, I really liked The Expanse, and I really liked Childhood's End as well.
Oh, yes.
I thought that as a major fan of Arthur C. Clarke's work, particularly Rendezvous with Rama and the 2001 series, or the Odyssey series, Childhood's End was one of my favorite books. It was one of the books that changed the way I viewed science fiction.
Same here.
And we haven't talked about literature at all. And Arthur C. Clarke's work has really resonated. Ray Bradbury's work stuck with me forever. It, you know, I mean, when you talk about what inspired me and influenced me, even beyond television, you got to talk about Robert Heinlein's early work, regardless of his own weirdness as a human being. His work was really strong. What's his name? Joe Haldeman. Was it The Forever War?
Haldeman, yeah.
The Forever War changed the way I viewed science fiction forever. Octavia Butler's work, obviously, you know, especially Kindred, changed the way I viewed what you can do, particularly as you bring in race, class, and gender into the storytelling. You've worked a lot. There was a collection that came out a few years back called Dark Matter, which was...
I have Dark Matter and Dark Matter 2.
So do I. And I know Sheree Thomas, and she's awesome.
I would love to interview her.
Oh, my God. If you like, I'll send it to you. I can connect you if you like.
She's a really awesome person, and she's very smart, obviously, but she's a really incredible person. And Dark Matter helped inspire me to continue with my career, because I was teaching when that came out, and I was as far away from being a science fiction writer then than I ever was in my entire life. And reading Dark Matter put me back on the path of wanting to be a screenwriter and writer again. So I have to thank her and all the people in that book, both books really, but especially the first one, that really put me on the path of moving forward into being a writer again, because I thought it was hopeless for me at one point. and I really mean it, because when I was teaching, I was as far away from being my dream than I ever, I mean, it was really sad in a way. But, you know, so like that stuff is really the stuff that is the engine for me. You know, and also Japanese creators like Leihi Matsumoto and Mamoru Oshii and Katsuhiro Otomo, Hayao Miyazaki, you know, folks like that have really deeply inspired and influenced my storytelling. So there's a lot out there that really keeps me excited, you know, and that's the beauty of it. And that was that's kind of the core of what I've been saying, is that there's so much incredible, beautiful stuff out there that there's really no need to complain.
Yeah,
there's no need to complain, because just turn your head to the left or to the right instead of looking forward. You'll see all this really cool stuff. So those, you know, and, you know, Philip K. Dick, I mean, good God almighty. Like the stuff, like even when his writing wasn't great, his ideas were just extraordinary.
I mean, in some instances, they hurt your brain in a good way.
They do. I mean, Blade Runner, I mean, well, do androids dream of electric sheep is a great concept. Then you get to stuff like We Can Remember It For You Wholesale. You get to, obviously, Man in the High Castle. You get to all his, like, short story collections from which stuff like Screamers came out of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so – good God. I mean, he's so beautiful, so imaginative. Then you look at stuff like the Russian science fiction community, like Stanislav Lem and Solaris, the original Solaris. You know, it's just – incredible stuff, and it hits you hard, and it forces you to see things outside of our own limited imagination, because no matter how broad-minded we think we are, we've only probably hit 0.0000009% of what's out there. There's so much great material out there. I'm constantly in a process of discovery, and that makes me feel good.
Yeah, I grew up a huge fan of mythology and legends. I was exposed very, very early to Norse mythology, Greek mythology, and from that I branched out into Celtic mythology, Japanese mythology, Chinese mythology, African mythology, Native American mythology, and I have an entire bookshelf that's nothing but different mythologies from different Native American tribes.
That's cool. That's really cool. Awesome. Wow.
So I'm gonna have to get you back on the show to talk literature. We're gonna have to just have like an entire day worth of just literature talk.
I would love that. I could talk about stuff I've read we haven't even touched on literature. I mean, I've read so many science fiction novels in the last year that blew my mind. Like, there's so much good stuff out there in science fiction literature right now.
That's just it. We need to start a campaign. It's like, people, go look for stuff if it's not coming to you directly. Just go look.
And that's what I'm getting at. Like, I swear to God, what I do from time to time is I get on Amazon and I just search for stuff. And I type in space opera and I just look for stuff. And then if I find a concept that kind of hits me hard, then I do research where I start looking at reviews of people who I trust. And then if I get enough good reviews, then I go and I actually buy the book, because I believe in buying the book and I believe in the author making money. And I look up the author to make sure they're not one of these lunatics, because there's some lunatics out there. but if it goes through my Brandon Easton vetting system, then I'll spend my hard-earned money on an author's work. And I have no problem doing it. And then defending them if the work is good.
Cool.
Yeah.
We're going to have to do this again. But
please.
Tell everybody where they can find you online, Twitter, your websites.
Sure.
So they can follow you for themselves.
Generally speaking, I'm on Twitter at Brandon Easton, exactly how it sounds. I'm on Instagram as Shadow Law Write. That's with two W's, is WRITE in the middle. Shadow Law is my first graphic novel, my first original. I'm on Facebook is Brandon Easton. You can find me very easily. I also do a couple of podcasts. I have Writing for Rookies, which is a podcast aimed toward aspiring science fiction, fantasy, and comic book writers of everything. It's all media. And I do another podcast with a writer named Brandon Thomas. It's called The Two Brandons, where we basically just argue relentlessly about everything. So, and I have a Writing for Rookies Facebook page where I invite people to just ask questions, because a lot of the members of that group are established writers of science fiction and fantasy and TV, film, and literature, as well as comics. So it's a great way for people to connect. And a lot of folks don't take it. For some reason, I have a lot of people in the group, but they never ask any questions. It's weird. So I strongly recommend, if you're an aspiring creator or undiscovered talent, please hit me up on any of those places. I'd be happy to send you some material or point you in the right direction. And I do panels at WonderCon and Comic-Con and Kamikaze in the L.A. area, or the Southern California area. I will be at San Diego Comic-Con this year, as I am every year. And I usually do about 2 to 3 panels. So just feel free to look me up and follow me on social media. And I look forward to meeting new folks and talking to you.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you, Brandon, for such wonderful, wonderful talk. I will have links to several dozen of the 2012 links where Brandon's work can be found. but right now, we are going to take a break, and I'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock. Peter Watts. Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pohl, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
I absolutely love conversations like that where you can just talk on end about various aspects of science fiction, fantasy, entertainment, in all its forms, comics, television, movies, books, you name it. That's the enjoyment that we're supposed to be getting out of our entertainment. Not just the arguing. Well, the arguing can be fun if it's constructive, but I'm not going to get into any Batman versus Superman arguments with anyone. It's just, life is too short. Sorry. Yeah, that'll do it for this episode. If you have any questions or comments, please call them in. The number is 602-635-6976. Leave a voicemail message. Give us your thoughts, your opinions, your perspectives, your questions. If you want to record something yourself that's a little bit longer, go ahead and do that and email a link for it to summer@sliceofscifi.com. Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review, leave us a rating. Let us know how you think we're doing. Check us out on Twitter, @SliceOfSciFi. Check us out on Facebook. I think the Facebook page is still there. I have no idea. I can't access it. We are Facebook minionless. Long story. Check us out on Google+ and on YouTube. We have some YouTube videos. Some of the reviews that Noah and Darren have been doing are going up on the YouTube channel, on Slice of Sci-Fi, on Slice of Sci-Fi TV, and on Pop Culture Geeks. Check those out. And as always, come here to this website, sliceofscifi.com. We also have In the Family, writersafterdark.com, kickassmysticninjas.com, and itscomicbookday.com. Thank everyone for your donations and your pledges via Patreon. They do help keep the websites and the media online. We are eternally grateful for your contributions and your support. Everyone, thank you. Thank you so much. And for all you new listeners out there, if you want to contribute as well, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. That's patreon.com/sliceofscifi. And as always, my special thanks goes out to the geek rock band Sci-Fried for the wonderful theme music that Slice of Sci-Fi now enjoys. Thank you, guys. And if you like geek rock, go head over, check them out over at sci-friedband.com and tell them Summer sent ya. But it's time to wrap this up. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.